As many of you know, I love movies, and I love Jesus. And because of that, I tend to see a connection between those two things. And I do try to avoid talking about that here, especially since, like, Easter some years ago, where I spent my whole sermon talking about the movie WALL-E, and I felt like I lost a fair portion of the congregation on that one. I have tried to restrain myself from talking about the connections that I see between Jesus and movies, but I cannot help myself this week. Not only because tonight is, of course, the night of the Academy Awards, but because there's a movie that's nominated for Best Picture that I think completely illustrates the passage that we just heard from Luke. Now, how many people here have seen the movie The Martian? The Martian. You knew it. You knew it. You saw The Martian and you were like, this is about Jesus. Yeah. Right? No, you're all with me. I look like we were running about 50%, so I think I'm not going to be completely, I'm only going to lose half of you on this one, right? How many of you, if you haven't seen the movie, do you know what the premise of the movie is? No, some of you have hasn't crossed your consciousness. Okay, that's fine. Quick summary. This is a movie that's about, it takes place sometime in the future, and it's about a manned mission to Mars. There's a crew that's maybe, I think, seven people who are planning a 30-something day stay on Mars. They have sort of a colony. Well, it's not, they're not going to live there for the long term, but they have a research station, sort of. A habitat that's been set up on Mars where they're living, but there is a terrible dust storm, and that forces the crew to evacuate midway through their mission. But they leave an astronaut behind. They leave an astronaut behind on Mars. They do it accidentally. Well, they know they're leaving him behind, but their technology indicates that he has died. There's no signs of life coming from their communication with his spacesuit, right? And so they realize that he has died. They conclude that he has died. So the rest of the crew evacuates, and they leave this guy behind. That's the premise of the movie, okay? Of course, he hasn't died. He has only been sort of stunned, knocked unconscious, and he comes sort of back to consciousness after they've left, and he realizes that he's been left behind on Mars, and then the story begins. Now, I knew that much about the movie before I went and saw it. I hadn't read the book, like some people here probably have done prior to seeing the movie, but I thought because of this, I concluded, as you, Bob, did, as you noted in your blog this week, I thought this movie was going to be like, you remember Castaway with Tom Hanks? You know, where he's abandoned, luckily with a whole load of UPS items, but he's abandoned on an island for some enormous number of years. Or maybe, what was that Robert Redford movie with the boat? All is Lost. You know, that this was going to be one of these man struggles, you know, to survive. Man against the elements. Kind of the battle of the rugged individual. And that is not what the movie was at all. Now, there is this original, there's a beginning part of the movie where our hero, Matt Damon, nominated for Best Actor for his role here, he comes back to his habitat, realizes that he's been abandoned, and he is very ingenious in figuring out how to survive. And among other things, he figures out how to grow food. He creates a little garden inside his habitat using potatoes. And he survives for some period of time with food that's been left in the habitat, but then he also begins to grow food for the future. And this goes on for a while, but eventually NASA back at home realizes through this satellite images, they can see that he's moving around with his little Mars rover up there, and they have this, you know, sinking realization that this astronaut is alive. And they actually go through some work and through very ingenious methods develop a way to communicate with him. And then the part of the story that really was interesting to me kicks in, which is to say they begin to figure out how to get him off Mars. And in order to do that, they pull in every resource, every team, every person, every idea, every nation, every piece of technological insight or imagination that they have, all resources come in and they figure out how to get him off of Mars. Spoiler alert. I have never seen a better depiction of cooperation. Do you agree with me? I mean, there was young and old, the sort of team player and the loner, the sort of people who are up at the upper ends of the chain of command, and people who are sort of underlings. All people have to sort of put in what they have to solve this problem. Everybody works together, and of course, across nations. China even comes in and helps, you know, make this rescue happen. And there's beautiful communication cooperation. When I saw this movie, I thought Ridley Scott, the director of the movie, had created sort of the parable for our time. That this was the movie that speaks to this moment in history. I mean, forget Mars. If we're going to survive on this planet, right, we are going to have to cooperate with each other. We're going to have to draw on resources that we haven't drawn on before. We're going to have to seek out the wisdom of people who we haven't wanted to talk to or people we've dismissed. We're going to have to work across nations, across disciplines, across levels of authority and command, right? All of us have to come together if we're going to survive in this life, on this planet. You're nodding, right? You agree, right? But you say, Heather, what does that have to do with Jesus? Well, my skeptical friends, take a look at the passage we just read. Take a look at this passage we just read from Luke. Now, this is a complex and confusing passage, in part because there's two sections to it, right? There's sort of this teaching that Jesus gives in response to a question that's brought to him, and then there's this parable of this fig tree that follows. And these two sections don't seem to be closely related. But let's walk through it a little bit. The passage begins because there's some people who come to ask Jesus how he makes sense of an event that has happened recently. Now, we don't know what happened. It's only referred to in this passage. It's not described anywhere else, but it seems to be an atrocity committed by Herod against Galileans. Okay, and so these are people who were innocent victims of a tyrant. And these people come and ask Jesus, hey, did this happen to these particular people? Did they die because of something they in particular did? Right? In other words, did God smite them? What's Jesus' response? Do you see that? That's very important. He says no. Just in case you ever wonder on that question, does God smite individual people for their particular sins? When something bad happens to somebody, is that because God is getting back at them for something that they did? What is Jesus' answer to that? No. Okay, say it a little louder.
No.
Right. That's important, isn't it? And then Jesus takes that a little further and he says, here's another story that is a story from current events. It's, these stories are 2,000-year-old stories, so we don't know them anymore. So it's confusing to hear them just referenced in passing, but we know these kind of stories because this one's about an accidental death, about a disaster. It sounds like a tower fell over on a group of people and they died. And Jesus says, well, what do you make of that? Were those bad people? And so God sent that tower and made it fall over and squish them? What's the answer?
No.
No, God doesn't do stuff like that, Jesus says. God doesn't, God's not a sniper, okay? God doesn't pick people off because of what they did. And so when you hear about something bad happening to somebody, don't conclude that they were being punished by God. Accidents happen on Mars and right here on Earth. Sometimes accidents happen. It wasn't God who made it happen. All right? But here's the confusing thing. And our worship task group picked up on this right away. Jesus says, yeah, but, what? Unless you repent, what happens? You're going to perish too. Well, that's a little confusing, isn't it? Because what is Jesus saying? Is Jesus saying, well, these people who died from Herod's action, these people who died because the tower fell over, those people didn't die as a result of their sins or something they did wrong. But you, on the other hand, you are going to get smote. Smitten. You'll be smited. Smote? You know what I'm saying. Is he saying the conclusion that you drew about who God is and how God acts, well, that wasn't true for all those other people, but for you, it is true. God's going to get you. If you don't watch out. So straighten up and fly right. Repent, right? Repent. So what does it mean? Is he saying no, but yes, yes, but no? Well, that wouldn't make sense, would it? So in order to understand what he's saying, read on. So right after that perplexing passage comes an equally perplexing parable. And in this parable, there's there's a vineyard that has a fig tree growing in it. Why? I don't know. But apparently this fig tree is not producing fruit. That's the situation. There are two perspectives on that situation. One perspective comes from the owner of the vineyard. And his perspective is that this tree is taking up space, that it has run out of time, and it should be cut down. The other perspective comes from the gardener. And the gardener says, what? Give it another year. We can make this thing produce fruit. We just got to pull in some resources and some techniques that we apparently didn't think to use before. Right? We're going to dig around the tree and we're going to pile up manure. And that's going to help. Give it a year. We're going to use these resources and you'll see things will turn around. Now, there's something interesting about these two perspectives. These two people actually agree on something, even though they have a different conclusion about what should be done with the tree. The landowner thinks it should be cut down. The gardener thinks it should be mulched and nurtured. But they do agree on this one thing. They agree that time is limited. They agree that this is an urgent situation. That's important, right? It's important because there's a way that an acknowledgement that time is limited can actually spur us to actions that we wouldn't take if we thought that we had forever. Now, Anne and Jean just spent a month or so discussing this kind of thing in a class that you guys taught here about the book, inspired by the book, on being mortal. That sense of when we have an awareness of our own mortality, There's a kind of a way in which it wakes us up, right? It wakes us up to the present moment, and it urges us, that awareness urges us to take action that we might have otherwise put off, ignored, or not even considered, right? So what kind of action do we take? That seems to be the question at the heart of this parable. So Jesus says, yeah, time is limited, man. And sometimes sudden deaths, sometimes accidental deaths, sometimes people who die before their time, that kind of shakes us, right? It shakes us out of our complacency. And that's good. That's good. That has a useful function in our life to be aware that we do not have an endless period in front of us. But what do we do with that sense of urgency? Jesus clearly wants us to have that sense of urgency. But what do we do with it? Seems like there's two options. There's the landowner option. That option is the one where when we have a recognition that time is limited, it freaks us out so much that we assume that everything else is limited too, even the soil. Right? Even the soil in our vineyard is somehow now is some sort of a under duress, a limited and limiting factor. When we have that sense that everything is scarce, the reaction then is what? To hold on tight to what it is that you do have, and maybe even to hoard a little bit more of it, and to defend yourself against anybody who might suggest that you need to share it. You know, that's why the sort of religious impulse that holds this sense of urgency at its center is sometimes a very kind of uncomfortable one to be around when you're just a mainstream liberal Christian. That sort of impulse is associated with weirdos who like stand on the street corner with signs that say repent, the end is near, right? People who are going to like tell you got to go sell everything and build a bunker in your backyard and stockpile, I don't know, bottled water or gold bars or whatever it is that you're supposed to do, right? That sense of holding tight because things are going to fall apart at any minute. That fear. But you know, that fear isn't only the property of people who build bunkers, right? That fear that we need to hold things tight and defend against anybody who might want to push in, we know that well. We know that well. It's maybe even too familiar at this point in our nation's life and the point where we're at. Personally, perhaps, the scareder we become, the less generous we become. But there is another way to respond to this sense of urgency that comes with a recognition that time is a limited resource. The other way to respond is the way the gardener responds. It's the way that the people in the Martian respond. It's the way, actually, come to think of it, most of the people involved with the stories in the movies and nominated for Best Picture respond. So, for example, when we have a sense that time is limited, things are urgent, all of a sudden we are willing to talk to people who we wouldn't have otherwise talked to. Bridge of Spies. Right? When we have a sense that things are urgent, that our resources are, that time is limited, we draw on resources that we wouldn't have drawn on otherwise. The Revenant. Huh? We find places of shelter that we wouldn't have otherwise considered. Huh? And then also when we have this sense that things are pressing, all of a sudden, we're willing to consider ideas that we had previously dismissed. We're willing to go back and rethink things that we had already dismissed as important. What is that one? Spotlight. And see, what I'm trying to say is that this message is all over our culture. This message is pushing in on us from all sorts of different voices. But the truth of the matter is, this message is our message. This message is at the heart of the Christian story. Because Jesus says, look, we're in this time. We're in this time of urgency. Things are pressing. Wake up. But when you wake up, what have you dismissed that you could now re-examine? What could you draw on that you have written off? Who could you talk to? Who could you invite in? Who could you open up to? Who could you connect with that you have disregarded, written off? There are resources that are abundantly available to us. Resources that we have not considered because we've been complacent. We need a kind of urgency in order to push past some kind of natural human resistance, the sense that we could do it on our own without the help of others. Not true. Not true, says Jesus. Not true, says Ridley Scott. Not true. And we got to have that other story front and center in our lives. This is a weird time to be an American. I don't know about you, but this past week, I've been in two separate conversations where people were talking about moving to Canada. If certain people are Ireland, the ones I was in, people were talking about moving to Canada if the people they don't like get elected president. This was not 100% a joke. In one case, one of the people had been actually on Zillow for most of the morning looking at prices of property in and around Halifax. The other person was planning a summer vacation to the Maritimes for the purpose of looking at property and considering what it might be to live up there. Okay, this has got to stop, people. There is no getting out. There is no getting off. No, there's not. There's no place. We cannot get into a spaceship and leave. Whatever it is that we need to do it together. And the sense of urgency we feel cannot drive us to the bunker, wherever we may locate it, here, there, or in our hearts. I know this is a scary time, and I'm not talking just about electoral politics. I'm talking about the various things that face us as people, as a nation, as occupants of this planet. And for some of us, that same sense of chaos and impending doom comes quite close. Comes close into our own personal lives, comes close into the lives of our family. And there's plenty of people who will tell us there's not enough to go around, that the driving principle of our day must be scarcity, protection, holding tight and guarding against. But that's not the voice we follow. We listen to a gardener. We listen to one who Mary mistook as the gardener when she encountered the resurrected Christ. That gardener is the one who we follow, who we disciple ourselves to. That's the one who stands there with the shovel. The one who stands there ready to dig. The one who says, I got another use for all that manure. Where you see something useless, I see an abundance of nourishment. I will be with you always, he says. that's the one who's at the center of this church, of my life, and of our story. Thanks be to God.